Welcome to Gonkcast, a long-form discussion podcast about the music of English electronic duo Autechre, album by album, EP by EP. I'm Gabe.
I'm Dan.
And this is an episode all about set A of AE 2022-Dash, Autechre's current mammoth, insanely ambitious live/not live project. And if that makes no sense to you, I'll explain everything in just a minute. First, though, a little bit of housekeeping.
In the interest of rebooting the podcast, we've decided to move everything over to Patreon. We're going to keep all the Autechre coverage completely free, since we know that that's what you're really here for. But one, we want to give the listeners a way to support us if you really like what we're doing. And two, we also want to start offering some bonus content that I think might make it worth your while.
Yeah, we both feel pretty energized right now, but we remember getting a little burnt out last time around just because doing this show takes a lot of work. So your support would really help with that, but we want it to stay totally optional. As for what you can expect from the show moving forward, we're first going to do a series covering the entire 2022-Dash project set by set. Then we want to do a series revisiting some of Autechre's major works, not to cover the entire discography again, which might be redundant. The whole back catalog is going to remain freely available, but to talk about albums and EPs our feelings might have changed about in the last 5 years, and also to give new listeners a chance to weigh in. We've heard from a bunch of people, actually, who discovered the show after the fact and regretted not being able to share their thoughts, so it'd be fun to get some new voices in there.
Yeah, as for bonus content, we were thinking that it would be a cool opportunity to cover some AE-adjacent music on the pod. For example, we've been thinking about the Tusks lately after hearing Mark Broom play a few tracks, and it would be fun to discuss that whole classic Tusks record. Square Pusher just reissued a neglected early release, etc. Plus, listeners are always asking us to cover different artists, and down the road, we want to let subscribers vote on the bonus content that they wanted to hear next.
That'll help with burnout too, just getting to talk about different artists sometimes. So the plan is to release a main episode on Autechre every 2 weeks, totally for free, just like it always was. And every other week, a bonus episode for subscribers giving $5 a month. If that sounds interesting to you, head over to patreon.com/gonkcast. Also, whether you're a subscriber or not, we want your emails about 2022-Dash, gonkcastpod@gmail.com. We love hearing everything you have to share, but try to specify the comments and questions you want us to read on the show, and try to be clear when you're talking about like a specific track or moment or the whole set overall. That'll just make it a lot easier to find the right place to slot things in. So Dan, should we get into the episode?
Yeah.
After our last episode, we heard from a lot of listeners urging us to cover AE 2022-Dash because they're feeling pretty overwhelmed by the whole thing. In fact, we heard from Energy is Massive Light on Reddit, along with Zytheon, the one putting all that hard work into analyzing the project on aepages.org, who expressed the same frustration we're feeling, that this is one of the most interesting things Autechre has ever done, but even hardcore fans might not get what it is because it's being released in the most obtuse way possible. Thus, we realized it might actually be a genuine service to the community to try breaking this project down set by set, not because we're authorities or anything, but because we could all help each other, indeed, hopefully with lots of listener write-ins, wrap our heads around this thing.
Yeah, so to recap the background information we brought up last time, Sean and Rob have basically said they're no longer interested in making traditional studio albums and that they don't see a meaningful difference between creating a track in the studio, on the bus, or in front of a live audience. Thus, their primary focus right now is creating live iterations of this one giant set they started performing in 2022 and have continued adding on to ever since, to the point now that it now forms a around 6-hour composition. And of course, they never do the whole thing at once. They perform it in sections, and fans, most notably on AE pages, have figured out how it all fits together by marking the overlap between where the sets begin and end.
Indeed, I think it's important to clarify that this isn't a case of like endless improvisation. Plenty of variation occurs within individual tracks from night to night, and set endings seem particularly loose. But for the most part, the guys seem to prepare and honestly rehearse a full set length continuation before debuting it for audiences. Thus, fans have been able to classify each performance as set A, set B, and so on. And by the way, their current shows at the time of this recording in November 2025 are set E.
So what we're discussing today is that first part, set A, which you can hear in 2022-, as it was performed in Milan, Athens, Helsinki, London, Bergen, and Turin in 2022, as well as Melbourne in 2023. They also performed it in Barcelona in 2022, and Tokyo and Krakow in 23, but those were not released. Bergen pushes the furthest into set B, which we'll talk about the next episode. Melbourne is the shortest. It stops a track earlier than any of the others. Again, we're heavily indebted to aepages.org for this information, which shows the overlap between performances, gives timestamps for the moments when one track seems to give way to another, though obviously these divisions are blurry given the fact that the music is continuous.
Indeed, Autechre has kept this whole thing as overwhelming and impenetrable as possible by releasing every set as a single hour-plus track. Why would we expect anything different? So we are going to roughly follow the track divisions on AE Pages to discuss this piece by piece. First, though, I want to talk big picture. It's probably safe to say, Dan, that set A is the most difficult and least loved section of the project so far. What do you think about it, big picture?
Yeah, I mean, I remember when these first were released, you know, putting it on, listening to it, and it is just like so impenetrable that I kind of just got overwhelmed by it and you know, never went further than just like having it on in the background sometimes. So I'm not surprised that that people feel that way.
Yeah, that's so funny because I think a lot of people probably bounce right off this because it, not only is it very challenging at the start, but actually, as we'll discuss, I think that the set A performances get a little bit more, like a little punchier, a little bit more propulsive as you kind of go. It's those first ones that are especially kind of meandering. So I bet a bunch of people just listen to like the first couple and are just like, I'm out, you know? I remember, yeah, when this dropped, everybody was like, drums are back, drums are back. And it is true, but it is not like super danceable as much as it is kind of like gurgling and bubbling the whole time. Yeah. There is almost no melody, like at all. It is actually kind of just this kind of weird bubbly percussion almost the whole time. Quite a noisy set. And I also think kind of like, I don't know how to put this. It's not very like directional. Like it doesn't like build necessarily. It just feels like a sequence of almost unrelated pieces. If anything, like if I had to say there's some kind of arc, I would say it starts in sort of a low gear and then maybe by the end is in a like two gears lower, you know? But
yeah,
you remember when we would talk about like the original AE Live and the 2016, 2018 sets, they both had this like big crescendo, usually like about two thirds through or something. And it felt like the whole set was building toward that. And then the rest of the set was kind of like descending from it. This doesn't do that, you know?
No, and, you know, I think that makes sense once we learn that it's part of this, you know, huge, bigger thing. But again, nobody knew that when these ones, you know, since this is the first ones, no one knew that. And I honestly didn't know anything about this until AE Pages and everything kind of, you know, brought it to the spotlight.
Yeah, you think that it could, like, it could it have a crescendo or should it have a crescendo or would it get, like, ridiculous if every piece of this kind of had like around the same spot, you know, a big climax? Because I guess it would get repetitive, but at the same time, nobody is ever, almost ever, going to listen to this whole thing start to finish, you know?
Yeah, that's what's like tricky about it is like if you're standing there in the room, you probably would vote for a crescendo. But when you're sitting at home and you're listening to, you know, all these things together, it would be lame if each one crescendoed about the same thing. It wouldn't feel like, you know, a giant 6-hour piece. It would feel like six separate pieces, you know, which it is in some way. Just sort of depends on how you're listening to it.
Yeah, I guess the big question, which we might not be able to answer until the end of this whole series, is, I guess I would put it like this. I think we have three options here, which is that one, despite the difficulty of this set, this eventually rewards the effort and stands on its own, just like everything Autechre has ever released. Option two, it doesn't quite stand on its own, but it's not supposed to. It's supposed to be the intro to a 6-hour 6+ hour opus. Or option three, that's not how 2022 Dash is supposed to work at all. If you don't like this, skip it and start wherever you want. Do you have like a preliminary thought on that, or do you think we need to get further into this to decide?
I mean, I definitely have to get further into it to completely decide, but just off the top of my head, you know, like when you say that's not how it's supposed to work, that makes some sense because, you know, it outside of them releasing this, you would only hear this if you're in the room and all. So it doesn't seem like they've given any sort of instruction or anything. And I think if you are wanting, you know, your audience to have that instruction, you got to give it to them. So I think just at this, you know, very beginning of everything, I'm going to say that I don't fully know.
Yeah. I was really trying to decide because I think that there are some times where I really enjoy this a lot. And of course we'll get into it, but overall, I just feel like it doesn't totally cohere into like one thing. I almost feel about it the way I feel about like records like Draft 7.30 or something, where it's like there are a bunch of like really cool moments, but it doesn't all glue together. And that makes it fun for exploration. But, you know, I don't think it's ever going to be like this set in particular, my favorite thing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, again, after just listening to set A for these past 2 weeks, I don't think I came away from it liking it more than the older AE lives. But but then, I mean, maybe once I've, you know, fully understood all 6 hours, maybe that'll change my mind.
You're right. We'll have to like go straight back around and do the whole series again after we've made it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to mention up top here is that I was actually thinking back to some of the earlier AE Live. I think it's so interesting. I think it's something we're going to talk about a lot. But like, I have felt for a while that Autechre's live stuff was on almost a different trajectory from their studio stuff. Like they were almost two artists or something, you know, operating at the same time. And yes, some stuff would, you know, move from the live set onto studio, but never in quite the same way. And I don't think with the same goals. So it's sort of interesting that now they are suddenly one, these two things. And it sort of feels like we have, I don't know, like I actually want to talk about this later because we got some listener write-ins about it already. But that Sine and Plus in some ways feel like a little bit of a, you know, like a side thing now. And that this is continuing on like a different path almost. I do think in some ways that it sounds more like Plus than Sine for sure, because Plus is a lot less melodic and a lot more bubbly and gurgly. And in that respect, it's funny because I think when Sine came out, people thought of that as the album and Plus as like the offshoot, you know, outtake thing, but yeah, actually it turns out to be a little bit closer. But I was also thinking, it's like a long-winded way to say that, I was thinking about those previous sets, especially 2016, 2018, and thinking about the fact that it seemed like Autechre was getting inspired by some of the earliest electronic music. I'm talking like electroacoustic, you know, Pauline Oliveros type stuff. And it's interesting because if you think about the history of electronic music, it basically starts as just people building machines that make noise. That's it, right? Yeah. And then they start to wrangle those noises into like beats and melody. But you know, you get a little further on into the development of electronic music and it's rough, you know. I almost feel like in a way, Autechre have been speed running the history of electronic music. And this set is like that moment where it's like kind of getting wrangled into music, but not totally, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, as we talk through the tracks, a lot of my notes are about like how pieces of it like seem like they're in the process of being wrangled or almost being wrangled or successfully being wrangled. So I totally agree with you there.
And I also wanted to ask, I have kind of a philosophical question that actually I would also like to hear from listeners if they have a perspective on this. But I found myself thinking like when you're listening to this set and maybe Autechre in general, do you think of it, and maybe it doesn't actually matter, but do you think of it as this started as a normal track and they have fucked it up, or this started as noise and they have kind of turned it into a track? You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. You know, chicken or the egg situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's a good question. I really have no idea. I guess actually, as we get further on, just a little bit, I looked ahead. I read through the AMA, the newer AMA a little bit. It seems like some of these later ones have some demo things that Sean showed. So maybe that'll elucidate that a bit.
Yeah. There might actually be. I think there's a couple things that we might have to say on that topic. But I just feel like overall, this set feels like something kind of struggling to be born from just chaotic murk or something like that. It has that kind of quality. All right. Last preliminary thing I wanted to ask is, like, do you have any sort of upfront thoughts about the trajectory of this set? I think it's really important to know. I almost like didn't even recognize this at first because I just sort of forgot. But what happened was the first couple sets, like Milan through Turin, were released first. All right. Those are the 2022 sets. And that means that they are all set A except for London B, which was like the second show they did on the same night, which was kind of an early fan favorite because it was the first set B. It was the first, like, not like all the other ones. I don't even think people maybe recognized that it sort of picked up from where the other ones left off at first. But anyway, it was then the next batch, which actually was like all the rest of it, I guess, where we got Melbourne, the very last set A. Now, this is crucial because that means there was like a good, 9 months passed between Turin and then Melbourne, the last time they played set A. So that means Melbourne like kind of doesn't totally count. You know what I mean? It's like, they took like a long gap. You kind of get what I'm saying? But like overall, do you just feel like set A, you feel it evolving over the course of these performances?
A little bit, but I think it's more, the more I listen to them all together, which I never really did when they first came out, like I said, the more, you know, like I could recognize, you know, where we are in the set and and seeing it, seeing that it is like pretty kind of locked in. I mean, they're certainly different. Yes. I thought a lot about it, like, this is almost like jazz, you know, it's like Coltrane's playing my favorite things every night, but it doesn't always sound exactly the same, but it is the same song. It like feels a lot like that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it kind of does a similar thing to the first AE Live, which is like they start speeding up a little bit each night, it seems. So by the time you get to Turin, it's actually like, I don't know, it's sort of, it almost finishes like at a similar place, but it kind of like is moving at a faster clip. You know, you just wonder if they're getting like impatient, or maybe the more they play it, the more they know where they want to take it, so they just hurry up and get there. And
yeah, I think it's likely more that, I mean, I guess we don't know, but it seems like, you know, a trim in the fat sort of evolution.
Yeah. And in fact, I think some of the transitions, like the transitions are way murkier, I think, in some of these early sets. And weirdly, you'll notice like by the time you get to Turin, they are a lot of times, not every time, but a lot of times just doing like a straight up hard stop. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing kicks in. And so the divisions are a lot clearer later on. And that's why I kind of think that, like, a lot of what I want to do with this is kind of help people out who are feeling a little overwhelmed by this. I think starting with like Turin is a great place to start because it's much clearer where things stop and start. And then you can go back to the murkier like Milan and Athens and stuff, and you can follow a lot easier.
Yeah, I totally agree. In fact, like I wrote most of my notes on Turin and Melbourne, because I thought it was like quite a bit easier to tell where the divisions were, and I wasn't so sure. I'm glad to hear you say it too, because I wasn't so sure if it's just me, oh, now I've listened to it so many times, yeah, I can tell, or if it was, you know, like as they got further on, you know, because I mostly did listen in order, you know. Yeah. So it was a little bit of I wasn't sure how I was if that was me or it was them.
I know. It's so funny because, like, literally don't do that. Don't listen in order because it is as hard as it can possibly be. Like, if you start with the later ones, it's a little clearer. I also think, like I said earlier, they're a little bit punchier and a little bit, they feel like they have a little more energy, a little more frenetic energy, I think. And I find them a much easier listen, whereas the earlier sets, earlier performances of the set. I'm trying not to confuse the words.
Oh, yeah. So, I didn't think about that.
The earlier ones are like, a lot murkier. Some of those transitions are really long. Like, I'll notice a sound coming in like way early and I'm like, oh man, they're already starting to kind of shift into the next thing. I will say though that it is definitely worth going back to the earliest performances, because I find in general they feel more exploratory, obviously, but they also feel, I think, kind of noisier. Like, there is a lot of that, you know, that like stuff that is whooshing and flying around the room. I was like so struck by this when I saw them live, you know, like it just, these like upper register sounds, it just feel like they are ricocheting around the room. Mm-hmm. I feel like those are a lot more front and center, and it makes this like noisier and more difficult, but in some ways like more interesting.
Yeah, totally. I totally agree with you.
Well, I think with that, we can start to kind of like dive in, and then we'll circle back and kind of see if our high level thoughts have maybe changed after we've talked about it. But let's start with track one, which if you look at A Pages, kind of covers the first like 6-7 minutes.
Could you? 6-7.
Ooh, I still don't know what that means, but I hear kids.
I don't either.
So if you could, can you try to explain like kind of what this track sounds like? Put it in words.
Yeah, I'll just read a little bit of my notes, I guess. But I thought it was, you know, it's like a drone. It starts with a drone, far away synth, you know, the, like buzzing, that percussion sort of coming, like, you know, it's bubbling up under the surface. There's some like bouncing drums that if I had to assign them to a part of the drum set, I would say they kind of sound like toms. But you know, who knows? Then like about 2.5 minutes on, I think I was on Melbourne when I wrote this, like all those laser guns start going off. And it's like it's like a sci-fi war. So, eventually, you know, kicks up. The laser gun sounds like remind me the way they made the sound of the laser guns in Star Wars is, you know what a guy wire is? Like,
no.
on a radio tower, the like big metal ropes that come, wires that go from the top, you know, keep it steady. If you bang on those with something like a hammer or a pipe, you know, or something, it makes this crazy noise.
Like a whipping noise.
Yeah. And that's what the laser gun is. And a lot of the laser, you know, it's like the sort of stretched, springy, like metal sound. And that comes up throughout the entire set, I think. But
yeah,
you know, that was what was really coming out in that first track for me.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because yeah, and by the way, I wanted to mention, you know, somebody had written in, and people used to write in this about this a lot and say like, couldn't you please play sound clips, you know? And I think that would be a lot of work, but I was kind of thinking that might be actually helpful here. But I was reading about this fair use stuff, and it seems like actually not, like it doesn't protect you very much at all. Like it's like a way you could defend yourself in court if you were sued, but you can't just say like you can't get a cease and desist and be like, oh, sorry, I don't have to desist. You know what I mean? It like doesn't actually work like that. So sorry, we're just going to do our best to put it into words, but I think you did a pretty good job. And I feel the same way that like when you're talking about these like laser gun sounds and stuff, it has this cool kind of like mini crescendo. I think this track really works like a great intro, like a prologue or an overture or something, because it kind of like swells up and makes this big, you know, just building, cascading kind of, yeah, metallic, noisy sounds. And then every performance, this actually ends with a hard stop before we almost kind of start the set proper. I think that works really cool. And I also like totally agree with you, which is like those kind of tom-tom type sounds. I sort of wrote down like it sounds like objects bouncing downstairs or something. It's got this kind of like, you know, messy, chaotic, like tumbling quality. And yeah, I think that there are some other interesting, like there's some interesting aspects where I think that early on it is a little bit bigger, like big booming kind of sounds. And then some of the later performances, it's a little bit, yeah, I don't know, a little bit more like Tom-ish or something. But overall, I think it's, I don't know, you like it? It's a cool intro, right?
Yeah. I mean, definitely cool intro. I think it works great as an intro, too, because it's a little bit, like, I think you sort of said this, but it's a little bit of a preview of what you're getting into. I think if you listen to this first 7 minutes and you hate it, then you probably can just, this isn't for you, you know?
Yeah, Yeah, quite possibly. And also, I was kind of writing down that I think in some of the earlier sets, like these are my notes on Milan, which is the first one. It because the blending between tracks is more gradual, even despite that hard stop, I think that you start to get like a ride come in, which is kind of previewing the next track. And it actually kind of comes together into like a pretty steady, kind of a cool beat by the end of it. I think like some of the later ones, it stays more like just an explosion of noise or something like that. But it's a cool track on its own for sure. Anything else about this one, or do we keep pressing on?
Let's keep pressing on.
All right. So these ones I have sort of grouped together into tracks 2 through 4. It's interesting actually, because if you look at AE Pages, they make reference to sort of a fan edit that kind of tried to group, like maybe the first serious edit to put all these together into one huge, you know, 6-hour track. And they make some different track decisions, you know, and I find myself a lot of times agreeing with them because they sort of group 2 through 4 into one big track, which interestingly, we might even think of as Ecole 4 from the album Plus, because in fact, in an AMA from June 2022, Sean said, so you can hear a bit of Ecole 4 in the set, Ecole 4 that was basically like the Ecole 4 that's on Plus when we started out. So that's kind of some evidence contrary to what I was saying earlier, which is that this might have started as Ecole 4 from Plus, which is certainly weird. It's still Autechre, but it's not this weird. And now this is like a twisted, warped, almost beyond recognition version that kind of stretches across like the next, honestly, 20 minutes almost. How would you describe the sound of this next section? Do you agree, like kind of grouping it together?
I do agree grouping it together. In fact, the first time I was like going through with the notes here, I wasn't fully reading it, and I saw you had just had minute 7:25 and really thought it was one track until I went through again. But this one, it's I think you get your first evidence of that like thing being born, you know. There's like a threatening normal beat, danceable beat that's always like bubbling under the surface, always like threatening to just become a normal song, but like at that same time there's shards of metal going everywhere. Like there's so many sounds in this, like I talked about the laser thing a minute ago, just seems stretched, like
yeah,
there's so much like stretch noise in this track and throughout the set, you know. And I think that's about all I got for now. Yeah.
Yeah, we don't have to try to take like the next 20 minutes all at
once.
I mean, yeah, I think that it's interesting because it kind of comes in with this big thump of like a kick with like almost a rubber band effect on it or something. You know, I was writing down words like floppy, you know, floppy kind of a kick, or something, which I think is really one of the defining sounds of the original Ecole 4 from Plus. And the other defining sound of that track was the like the use of ride cymbals. It's like kind of sounds like there are various and they sound a lot of times in Ecole 4 like pretty clean almost, even though you know they're like digitally created, but like various tones of ride cymbal. And I think that is kind of the star of the show of this version as well, except for they are messing it up way more. In fact, I think the pro tip for this next section is like try to just listen to the ride cymbal like the whole time. It is the craziest, trippiest journey like you've been on, because you know I was writing down stuff like this sounds like the ride cymbal has been deflated, if that was possible. You know what I mean? Like it's just the craziest stuff. And I kind of think if we think about like the way they use algorithmically generated sound, like the way they use Max MSP, right? They are setting parameters of how much these certain things can change. And usually I think that that is fairly tight. But here it feels like there are, you know, almost no parameters, right? So there are points where the what was a ride cymbal is turning into like just sheets of droning noise. Sometimes it's really low. Sometimes it's suddenly very high. It takes like all different forms. I honestly was thinking about AI a lot while I was listening to this, because you know how when you see sometimes like a picture or a video like AI generated, it gets kind of surreal because the it doesn't understand like conceptually what it's working with. So like I was looking at this video. Somebody had generated like what would be like a third person video game sequence generated by AI. And so there's this soldier. He's got like this gun. He's like shooting on a subway platform. He gets in the train. It moves like three stops. He gets out and now he's on top of a skyscraper, you know, because AI will never understand like how a city is actually supposed to work, you know? Mm-hmm. This kind of has that same quality. Like you tried to explain to AI what a ride symbol is, but it will never understand. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that's the perfect like description of what I mean, like by the, like those things becoming born or almost becoming like a normal mm-hmm. beat. I thought of it the same way. It was like a computer, like, I think I wrote further down in the set, you know, like you remember that, infinite monkeys type in, you know, mm-hmm, will write mm-hmm. Shakespeare. It's almost like that. It's like, you know, like the computer, if it makes every noise ever, you know, it'll make a normal beat. And it felt like yeah. that was like always sort of coming. But I like your AI thing because you're right. You know, like we end up on top of the skyscraper when, you know, like visually that can be made, but it doesn't make any sense, you know, sort of.
Yeah. Yeah, just listen to the ride this whole time and just like hear how many like weird shapes and versions it takes. I think it's just like kind of endlessly interesting. And then for the rest of the track, you know, I kind of think that it's interesting because it sometimes starts off with like this big booming kind of floppy kick, but they seem to kind of tone it down into honestly like I was jotting down like Burial comparisons. Like it gets this kind of like tap click kind of a quality that's like, you know, dubstepy or like garagey mm-hmm. kind of and you know it ends up being kind of like, you know, pretty mellow. Like I said, it starts in kind of a low gear this set and never really goes too high above that, but kind of mellow like bed for you to I think pay attention to like the noisy explorations of this weird like play with the ride. And then I think by the time we get to like the end of this section, because again, some people have divided this into like three different tracks, even though I think it kind of just carries on. But by the time you get to the end, you kind of get this like, I don't know if it's the kick or something else, but it starts to resemble like a really loose bass string. You know what I'm talking about? That part where it just gets like really extra floppy and bizarre. I don't even know if that's like a full track in its own, but it just feels like the end of this piece, which I think is kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I heard some like water kind of noises that gave me a little bit of the Burial feel too, just like water that's like digital water, you know, like I yeah. felt that throughout this a lot.
Yeah, and then I think that by the end of this you start to hear a little bit of the transition into the next section. When you hear like suddenly a very clean kind of a hi-hat come in, but it's very like lightly tapped. It kind of sounds like brushes on a really standard clean hi-hat. And I think that's kind of previewing us of the next section, which is, I've again kind of grouped together tracks 5 and 6, and I've sort of named it like the goofy arpeggio part, because I think this to me is a highlight. Like, do you know exactly what I'm talking about? That like,
oh yeah,
that kind of awkward, lumpy arpeggio that comes in.
Yeah, yeah, but that hi-hat, I think this is the good. This when you're first getting into these, this was like the first track in the set where it's a good like delineating part of that normal sounding hi-hat. Like this is, I would listen to this a lot when I would go on my walk every day, and like it. Every set, it happens pretty much at the same spot of my walk, you know, mm-hmm. and it was just like a real, you know, anchor point of like, okay, now, you know, we're in this, we got, you know, anchored by the only normal sounding sound, basically on this set. Sometimes on some of the sets though, that hi-hat is like way louder than others.
Yes. Yes.
And I think it kind of gets louder towards the end too, like towards the later sets, like Melbourne, I think. It was like so loud. And I remember in the London A, I think that was like the sweet spot of it. It's like just sort of in the background, but it's not blasting you. I think it sort of comes in a little too much. But that goofy arpeggio part, I sort of thought it sounded a little bit like almost like a circus organ that was like trying to kick up or something.
Yeah, I was thinking of like my theory of Autechre or speedrunning the history of electronic music. This is like Tangerine Dream or something, but like maybe even a step before that, because it's got this kind of like boom 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 boom, 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 and that really loud hi-hat. I mean, it's so hilarious to me how loud it is, because it just accentuates the like slightly offbeat, like unquantized quality of this whole section of the track. It just, everything sounds like kind of off balance and lopsided. I think this enters, we got to do a whole episode on this honestly, but like the pantheon of Autechre comedy tracks, like BQ, which I remember you were always a big defender of on NTS sessions. I think the last track on Plus is kind of funny, but I don't know, like everybody thinks of Autechre as like being very serious, and I guess they mostly are, but they can also be quite playful and funny, and I think this is a good example of that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I like I said, I think that it like it's got a, like a circus organ quality. That hi-hat is like, it's the same in what was the song on, I think it was on Sign, that they like, it's just a normal 808 and it's like the strangest thing, because
Arhide.
Yeah. I think that is it. You know, it's so normal that it's like out of place and you know, sticks out like a sore thumb. And I feel
like
that,
a little Lynchian, like it's weird.
Yeah,
it's like so
yeah,
normal,
exactly.
It's weird.
It's so normal. It's weird. Exactly. But you know, again, I think that hi-hat is like such a key in this set. It's like if you focus on it, it lets you kind of figure out how the beat is there, you know, like it's I already called it like an anchor point, but I think it totally is. I think it's like really the key that made me start understanding all this, and because all these tracks, this whole set, it's so like when you look at it as a whole, I think the whole time it feels like very chaotic, but then like as you listen to it more, and maybe I don't know if understand is the right word, but just we'll say that, and you focus in, you know, like sort of looking at it more like granular, I feel like a lot of times like the individual pieces are not chaotic or not weird. It's the, you know, the whole gives you a different picture than the piece, you know. It's like the universe, you know, if you look at it like as one as one thing, it's kind of smooth, but
trippy.
Yeah, but you know, you zoom in and it's actually, you know, chaotic things.
You know what I think it is sometimes is like, I think that we have a tendency to try to use the kick as an anchor, and it's the worst thing you could possibly focus on here. Like, it's usually the most chaotic thing and what is likely to lead you astray. But yeah, I also just wanted to add that I think that hi-hat and then also kind of like the just effect of the arpeggiating synth, it sometimes takes on like kind of a like a tabla type of a quality. Like sometimes the hi-hat goes on like a run where it suddenly hits like 16th notes, and it gives me like just a cool rush the way that I think sometimes like Tangerine Dream and stuff like that kind of does.
Yeah, totally agree.
All right, so that what we were talking about is track 5, and this kind of, I kind of see this as like almost continuing in track 6. I don't even know if I see track 6 as anything more than like kind of a transition that starts to lead us into the next major section here. But just like to kind of, just to clarify, we are about like 30 minutes into the track. So like almost halfway what we've discussed. I should mention that, like I said, some of the later tracks start to, or the later performances start to speed up a little bit. So like London, Bergen, and Turin, by this point, they're almost like 10 minutes ahead. But we are around 30 minutes into like what I would call the average set. And, you know, this track 6 thing. All right. So where I think we are kind of going, this doesn't, I almost think of track 6 as like having elements of that previous part and now elements of the next part to come. But the thing that sort of joins in here is what I was calling in my head the whole time, like a tri-repete sound, basically. It's like this kind of clanky, like chimey, distorted, you know, loop, basically. Sometimes it sort of stutters, but it has this kind of like robotic, mechanical feel that starts to creep in. I think that becomes almost like a central motif for the next long section, but it's here toward the end of this that I start to hear it. And I don't know, I'm a little bit at a loss of like how to even describe this next just couple minutes before that kind of really takes over. I was writing that we sort of get like like the bass starts to kind of like, I don't know, it's almost like a bass solo we get here. Like they start playing with the bass, and I was writing down like, is this like a square pusher track or something? Are we getting a bass solo basically over this? But I don't know. I'm a little at a loss. Like, do you also find kind of the end of this gets like quite, you know, nebulous?
Oh yeah, of course. I the whole track six, I think is like the most sort of in between sort of, you know, going from one to the next, like you said, it's very nebulous, just sort of feels like that in between of five and seven.
Yeah, so we can just move on to seven, which again I have grouped the next two tracks together, tracks seven and eight, and this kind of covers like, you know, around minute 35 to around minute 45. And like I said, by this point, I think that kind of looping tri-repete sound, I hope everybody who listens to this knows exactly what I'm talking about, because it feels like such a throwback for them, honestly. But that almost becomes like the central just loop. We then get kind of some, like by this point, the kick is kind of like just a really light tap. You know, we kind of get like the snare is like just kind of a light click. And then we get what I was writing down is like just a very shockingly dubby bass line kind of comes in. And then the sort of defining feature, I think, of this next piece is we get a patch directly from the track F7 from Sign, memorably track two. And it is kind of shocking because we are, what, like 35, 40 minutes into the set. And this is like the first beautiful, pretty, you know, brilliant, shimmering synth pad in the whole set. What would you add to kind of describing this next section?
Yeah, I think too, there's a lot more metallic noise. I think a lot of times it sort of sounds like change jingling, you know, it's sort of like that. So much of this set, and I mean, maybe Outtaker in general, like it really kind of like feels like it's playing with stereo. Like it feels three-dimensional, you know, like things seem to sort of bounce around. And I think you sort of mentioned it at the top, but when you're there in the room, it kind of like is a lot more pronounced. It works in your headphones too, I think. But like, you know, when it really feels like, when you're in a dark room and it feels like it's bouncing around, it's something you can never really, yes, you know, ground yourself. I think this section really starts playing with that quite a bit.
Yeah, it's like the audio version of 3D modeling or something. Yeah, like creating shapes, you know, in space. And yeah, you really start to feel that here. But yeah, I think that this kind of just beaming F7 thing kind of like shines through. I think if you spend a lot of time listening to Sign, you'll recognize immediately. And then they pretty quickly start to mess it up, as they are wont to do. You know, I think that it starts to get like very metallic guised, like you were saying. I was trying to think. We could make up a new genre, electronic with metal sounds. We'll call it Metallica.
Oh, that's good. Nobody's ever great thought of idea, that one. Right? Yeah, great. I'll write it down.
So anyway, it gets very... I was writing down like a comp to like Portishead's track Machine Gun, one of my favorite tracks, where that really has these kind of like metal, like strange sounds to it. So I don't know. It's kind of like a cool... It's kind of, I just find it very interesting, this kind of dubby quality. And in fact, that sort of looping, chiming sound, I also wrote down a comp to like, you know, when you strum, if anybody plays guitar, if you strum like above where the neck actually starts, it makes like this chiming type of a sound. You know, it's got that kind of a quality. It's crazy because it's hitting like on the two and the four, it adds kind of like a reggae quality to this. You know how like in reggae, they always are kind of like clicking, like palm muting, just the like... So I don't know. It's kind of like a weird, like little, I don't know, like unusual, I think, for them, like this whole piece, but really interesting. And then I think that track eight is kind of just a continuation of this, but that dubby bass line, they start to kind of hold notes, and that makes it quite like they're like hold really deep kind of bass notes. And that makes it kind of like, you know, a little droney at the end of this.
Yeah, I agree. I agree that I think these two sort of go together. In my notes, I wrote that this is one of the more, you know, normal sections, and I think it is like because of F7 and all, you know, like there's some melody to hold on to, you know, like if you're already listening to Outtaker, I feel like this is the section where you're like, oh, okay, you know, I know where we are kind of thing as much as you ever can.
Yeah. This might have a little something for the old heads. I think you're right about that actually. And then, so then we move into what, you know, we could call track 9, the next track. And I really think of these next several tracks, honestly, in some ways all the way to the end, as really like the clearest example of this is almost just one continuous development. I don't know if I even feel comfortable saying this is like different tracks, but it has sort of an interesting transition, which is that by the time that kind of F7-ish part ends, it leads us to basically a lone kick, just doing like a very light tap of a kick drum, doing like a 4/4 beat. It's like the most standard thing that's happened the whole track so far, but it's just beating on its own. And then it kind of, at a certain point, we get this kind of like clicky snare joins in. They seem to sort of just like add some swing to that 4/4 kick, and it starts kind of stuttering, bouncing a little bit. And then I kind of think of this as like maybe the danciest part of the set. I wouldn't call it dancey, but like the danciest, where this kind of clanging, I mean, clear metal kind of pattern, like almost like a tom-tom type of pattern, quite groovy actually, joins in. And then on top of that, we get, I was always calling this like the bleep bloop part, because we get what really has kind of like a water droplet, kind of a bleep bloop pattern, which it's got kind of a nice groove to it. I was kind of always comparing in my head this part to, maybe I'm the only person that's kind of obsessed with this, but I always loved the last track on that Thom Yorke solo record, The Eraser. The last track is called Cymbal Rush, and it has this really weird, like kind of bloopy pattern. I always loved that beat, and I feel like this kind of scratches that same itch a little bit. But do you agree with me? This is kind of like, this grooves a little bit more than anything in the set. And so to your point about the previous track, I feel like we have kind of entered like a section that might actually be more broadly appealing if anybody could make it this far into the set, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I think like, you know, we've been, I think that gives this some credence to the it all being this one giant piece, you know, because if you think about it, like, what are we like 40 some odd minutes into it by now? Like 40 minute intro-ish, it just sounds ridiculous, but 40 minutes out of 6 hours or more, you know, it's not done. So, you know, it makes a little bit more sense. But yeah, I think we're in like as close as we get to a dancey section here. I wrote the same thing, like the metal clanking. It reminded me of like Stomp or like a street musician, you know, like someone playing on like everyday, you know, metal objects. Like I was thinking of, you know, like a guy like playing the spoons or something, but like you know, just digitized, so almost to the point of like where only the metal is left, you know, like you could tell it's metal but you can't tell what it is. I do think that these all kind of go together, like you were saying, but there are like in Turin, I think there's a pretty like obvious switch to track 10. Like there's, it's almost like a record scratch kind of like stopping point starting, but without following along on these track times, I don't know that I would like, it would immediately jump out to me, but when you look at it, I could definitely like see that as a breaking point.
Yeah. I mean, for sure, because I think that clang disappears. Like eventually that just straight up cuts out and we are left. And actually, I think they start to kind of low pass filter like a lot of the elements of this track, and it starts to get like kind of dreamier and a little more ambient. I think those like those bleeps and bloops, they start to, yeah, the reverb kind of like gets turned up and it starts to get quite dreamy. I think by the end of this like track 10 section, so we're really getting, you know, really like 50 minutes or so into the track, getting close to kind of the conclusion, it starts to get kind of shoegazier here. And I was writing down comps to like See Feel, you know, which of course is kind of like electronic music, but with like, you know, sort of like shoegazy treated guitar type stuff. It starts to get quite dreamy and dense, I think. I mean, do you think shoegaze is like a bad comp for this sort of, as we transition into the end here?
No, definitely. I mean, I thought here too, like I was talking about earlier, like this was a really like caged, you know, kind of that low pass filter. Like the synth was always like sort of threatening to break into a song. And I feel like, you know, shoegaze can have that same thing, you know, as like a wall, the sound is built, you know, and whatnot. Like oftentimes, like, in this wash of everything, you know, like one or two things kind of cuts through and you feel that. And I feel like that's happening here, in particular in this track, but throughout the whole thing.
Yeah. And then I think as we kind of get into what we would call track 11, I think that kind of drony, shoegazy sort of layer of sound, it starts to kind of get pulled apart and turn into like big whooshes that are sort of flying around your head. It really reminds me a lot of, you know, the very beginning of this, of Sign, like the first track, M4 Lima. It has this kind of like you're flying through space before you kind of get your bearings. It starts to get that kind of like big whooshes flying past you quality. Meanwhile, the beat, or sort of the low end of this track, it starts to kind of like tone down and down to the point of, I think, resembling kind of a heartbeat a little bit. And that's why I kind of think of like this last maybe 15 minutes as like almost like one section, because we start off with the grooviest part of the piece and it sort of gets like dreamier, dronier, and more of like a heartbeat instead of a groove. I think in kind of like an elegant way that sort of leads us to the end, you know?
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
So, we then get to track 12, which is sort of like the last couple minutes of most of these sets. This is the usual stopping point. By this point, I sort of called it like the drone / heartbeat section, but I think it has kind of a similar quality to the intro of this whole piece, in that those kind of like whooshes of sound, as the whole thing settles, they simultaneously sometimes kind of like crescendo or swell up. I mean, sometimes it has kind of like an organ type feel where it's sort of like, you know, it really feels like a little bit of an outro, right? With like kind of a miniature crescendo, the same way the thing started. I don't know. What would you add to kind of describing like this standard conclusion part here?
Well, first I would say it definitely has that outro sort of feel. And I wonder, like, was this initially going to be, you know, multiple sets?
I guess the same exact thing.
Yeah. I guess because, you know, they already play set B in London, you know.
Right. Well, you know what we didn't talk about is that this was supposed to be a 2020 tour for basically Sign and Plus, but COVID derailed that whole thing. And there are quotes in which, you know, in preparation sort of for that tour, they were describing the set as like almost done, which suggests to me that there was a point when this was originally going to be a tour that it was just supposed to be like the first part. I kind of believe that. And I think that this has such a clear conclusion. I mean, really, it sort of sounds like we end where we began in like a very self-conscious way, that I kind of believe that it was an original thing. Now, of course, they would have messed with it over the 2 years before they actually took it out on the road after COVID delayed things. But that almost makes me wonder if like maybe this did have kind of a crescendo the way all their other live sets have had. And they decided at some point, you know what, let's make this more of like a slow burn leading into, you know, something bigger. You know what I mean? Like maybe there was a crescendo and they took it out to make it now more of like an intro piece.
Yeah, totally. I could totally see that. Yeah.
And then, you know, the only other things I wrote down was that I think this last track 12, it has sort of like there's sort of like a shimmering, hanging, like suspended in air kind of feeling with like sort of like nice light drones sort of in the distance. Mm-hmm. I think kind of, I honestly think, and you know, we can start to transition into, because I wrote down tracks 12 plus because Athens, Bergen, and Turin kind of extend beyond this quote-unquote standard ending. Athens reaches what fans have kind of decided is track 14. Bergen reaches track 15, and Turin reaches track 13. But we are, one, going to talk in much more detail about these pieces when we talk about set B on our next main episode. So I don't think we need to try to get as granular here, but I think in general, I have a hard time kind of delineating like what is even going on past track 12. It feels almost like just a continued, you know, much more ambient drift type of feeling. Like, did you have any luck like feeling like, oh, this is going somewhere or what?
No, it sort of feels like extended outro on these. And especially I'm looking at the like delineations right now, and the London B doesn't have track 13. Mm-hmm. You know, it starts at 14. So it's almost like, you know, was that, did that exist then? But then I guess Athens does go to 14. That happened before. So maybe, you know, who knows? But yeah, it always sort of felt like an extended outro whenever we got past 12.
Yeah, very exploratory. I think that the other thing to note about Athens, maybe I should link this in the show notes, but I was sending you this today. Oh, I hadn't seen it before, but the venue that they perform the Athens show is like this gorgeous, I mean, it's in these ruins. Like, I don't even know where exactly it is. I actually read that they had to like keep the bass not so intense because you would like shake the ruins apart which would be crazy. So metal,
but it's like Live at Pompeii.
yeah but it's like the most beautiful place you've ever seen, and I just imagine that they kind of wanted to like hang out there, you know, so that's why that's mm-hmm. the longest set here. It's like an hour 20 minutes. And so I don't know, but it just has like this whole ending just kind of has this like exploratory, like almost sustaining the energy of the set. And I don't know, it's my theory. You're right that London B does carry on, but there was still quite a lot of time before they really started pressing on. You know, it wasn't until mm-hmm. like 2023, like a year later, that they really like in earnest started pressing on. And we'll talk about this next week, but set B is like the weird stepchild of the group, because there are only two sets that we would call set B, and they have so much overlap with what came before and what came after that they almost like, they don't have a ton of original material in the middle there. Mm-hmm. And this is all to me just like suggesting, I don't know if this works, but suggesting that it was somewhere around here that they got the idea to start growing this thing. Like that wasn't originally in the cards. You kind of agree with me?
Yeah, totally. You know, I think that's definitely, you know, gotta be true, because if you look, I mean, this is getting ahead of ourselves, but you know, if you look at that London B, it starts around track 14, but then Venice starts at like track 9, you know, for a B. So there is quite a bit of overlap.
And they don't normally do that. I mean, from then on, they have pretty clear like starting and ending points. This is the only like weird wishy-washy one. So yeah, something kind of like, I don't know. I bet the idea sort of grew a little bit organically. And, you know, so on one hand, that makes the kind of end of this set, it's kind of weird exploratory, like ambient drift quality, make a lot of sense. On the other hand, I think it makes it make even less sense that this set doesn't have a crescendo or like a standout moment. I mean, we can start to transition now, I think, into kind of zooming back out to high level thoughts. And I want to know like if anything has sort of changed about your overall impression now that we've kind of talked about it a little bit more. But I mean, part of my feeling is that this just doesn't have like a, you know, Blade of Loris or something. Like it needs some like absolute banger somewhere in the middle that everybody agrees is one of the best Autechre tracks of all time, and that would like elevate it a lot. But as is, it just doesn't have that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. But I again, it's if this is a 1 hour thing, then mm-hmm. I think it's a negative. But if it's part of a 6 hour thing, you know, it makes a lot more sense that, you know, maybe we just haven't gotten to that crescendo yet. As far as my overall impressions, I like I said, when this first came out, you know, I never really got past a kind of background, just throwing one on, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Probably most of the time in order, which I agree with what you said, not the best way to go about it. You know, but how would you know? I think this definitely, I mean, talking about it, of course, and just repeated listening and 100% following along with this AE page. I think without that, I would be totally lost, and I don't have the patience or anything to put that together.
Yes.
You know, so a million thanks to them. But it is like becoming something that I'm I hate to use the word understand again, but like that I'm starting to understand or something. It's becoming like when we were like joking about this a little bit when I was up there visiting you, but you know, like it's like they're Stockhausen, you know, like if you just put that on, it sounds like, you know, noise, you know, but when you dissect it, look into, you know, like learn it, that goes away, you know, and it becomes something. And I feel like that this is starting to do that for me.
Yeah, it has. I mean, stuff to find. I think that they're like at this point, I can sort of clearly tell the difference between the pieces. Like we talked about, there are a couple pieces that I see as just kind of fundamentally transitional. Like they don't have any like defining thing about them. And I just see them more as like the last thing kind of giving way to the next thing. But I would say like the majority of this, like each piece has something about it that is kind of like the hook, like the thing that you listen to at first. And through that, you start to kind of like, yeah, quote unquote, understand the pieces around it. And I do think it rewards that. I think that there are some parts like that kind of goofy arpeggio part that I love, I think are just like awesome. And then there's a lot of like really cool stuff, but I just think it is missing some kind of like anchor or something to the set. And yeah, like you said, I mean, maybe that won't matter so much if we, as we press on and we get to know more of it, like maybe we'll feel like this is kind of a fitting intro. But I would just be really curious to hear from listeners about, yeah, what do you think? Do you think this like works on its own, or do you think we shouldn't even treat it like that? We should treat it like the intro of a 6+ hour thing. So I wanted to ask you, because we got some emails. We asked last episode, like, hey, is anybody actually listening? And actually a lot of people wrote in, and a couple of you even wrote in with like comments that I think would be great for this first episode, which was really convenient. Thank you. So I wanted to read this email from Joe, which I think kind of sums up like some big picture questions I have. So Joe writes, you guys have always had excellent discussions on the pod about AE's interest in using format and creating music that specifically fits it. I'd like to point out that their first attempt to try to do something that doesn't fit any predefined existing format was LSEC, which is also more or less what a studio version of the current set would be. Edited live sequences, LSEC, right? As was discussed back when you covered that release, it seems to have suffered a bit by not really being here nor there and not fitting in any way into a logical format, which is a reason why, despite being even longer and often more challenging in terms of the music, NTS was far more listenable and successful overall. I think that they're very happy right now with playing with a format they haven't really explored in this way before for the first time, which is these cascading live sequences. It fits as a logical progression from the exploration of formats and versions that started out with the Quoristis cinematic universe and continued with XI, LSEC, and NTS with Overstep, Sign, and Plus, feeling a bit like sidesteps in this overall progression. I think that his quotes about studio albums feeling outdated might refer to how they feel about Sign and Plus looking back, and although I loved both of them, there was a bit of disappointment in the community at the time about how neither felt as trailblazing as their succession of increasingly massive releases. So I think Joe raises a couple really important points that I want to get your take on, which is, one, yes, this is extremely consistent and honestly like the next logical step with something that they have been doing for a long time. You know, you could go back to like Quoristis actually, which was like this kind of attempt to capture and be almost stuck with like live iterations and then release various versions that would kind of like, you know, reflect on each other a little bit. But yes, indeed, like with LSEC and NTS, they were kind of like exploding the album concept and playing with format, kind of like, I mean, you could even go back to like Minidisc, the way that they were interested in format all back then, or the way that Tri Repete is incomplete without surface noise. You know, they've always been interested in format, and this is like a new format for them to explore. So that's one thing. The other thing is, does it feel, I was kind of alluding to this at the beginning of the episode, but does this all make it feel a little bit like Sign and Plus are kind of like, you know, sidesteps that in retrospect aren't that important, you know?
I think it does sort of push Sign and Plus to the side a bit. I mean, maybe even in my own personal listening and stuff, I those are the ones I kind of go back to the least, I think. And even I remember when they came out not being like as excited for them, you know, like something like NTS and LSEC like really piqued my interest, and again because I think it was like the format thing, you know. NTS, it was fun. Like, remember each, I don't remember if it was 4 days in a row or 4 weeks. You remember, like, they played it live on the radio.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I listened to them live every time they happened and stuff, you know, so, like, that was kind of fun. Gets you in there. You know, LSEC, just like this, like, you know, what the hell are we doing, you know, kind of thing. But then, you know, yeah. Sign of Plus were just kind of back to the regular album. It is like... how far into 2020 did those come out? You know, like, was it like we can't tour, might as well release something? Or were they kind of early in 2020? I don't have it right in front of me what month they were.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I do feel like they were kind of early. And I mean, I think all indications suggest that this was always the plan, you know, to like release two albums. I mean, in that respect, it is kind of consistent because it's not just like a standard
September.
Album.
September.
Okay, well... That was Sign?
Oh, Sign was a record released October 16th, 2020.
Really? And yeah. When was Plus?
Well, I don't have that in front of me. It was October 28th.
Okay. All right. So like a month later.
And then physically, so, right, so, November 20th, yeah.
So that's pretty late in into COVID. So maybe they already knew that the tour was bust or something like that. That's interesting. Interesting thought. I guess, but it is still kind of like exploratory because it's two albums that it's very unclear like what their relationship is. Mm-hmm. But there is indeed some crossover. You know, there's some tracks that like the titles and even the sound of them indicate that they're like versions of each other or something. Mm-hmm. So they're not as standard as maybe it seems, right? They're still like really playing with format, I think. And at this point, we know that, yeah, this is clearly one of Autechre's favorite things. And I think this idea of like live iterations of this ever-growing thing, it is, yeah, kind of like a next logical step. It definitely continues something. And I just find it like endlessly funny how you never know, like in retrospect, like what is going to be crucial. Because I think that a lot of people were, I felt this at the time, a lot of people were like dismissive of Choristus, you know, as it was like, oh, this is like it's not as dense as they usually are. It's like a bunch of like 2-3 minute tracks that are, you know, there's not as much going on or, you know, and that seems to almost be like that first, one of the first steps on the direction that they've stayed right on, you know? I don't know. It's just interesting how that works out. The other thing that's funny is we got another email from Tom, who broke down what he sees as every Autechre period. And I just thought it was so funny because, like, in light of Joe's email, because he grouped Sign and Plus in what he called period 6.5, the COVID moment, an outlier in the AE live period, feels like a reimagination of the second classical period with the sound world of the AE live era. But I'm just fascinated by that. Like, it seems like consensus is forming that Sign and Plus are... like I said, it's like period 6.5, like an outlier, like an offshoot rather than the main next step for it. I just think that's so funny.
Yeah, no, I've totally come to think of it that way, like in my own listening, you know, since stopping the podcast before, you know.
Interesting. Well, see, these are the reasons why we got to, you know, because
yeah, exactly.
We got to revisit some of these records, you know, because I feel like really the more we know, like the more my mind changes about some of these things. And
yeah, totally. Uh-huh.
I would be really interested to revisit. But any other sort of thoughts? I feel like we, I don't know, listeners will have to tell us, but I feel like we did a decent job digging into the nooks and crannies of what is still a pretty dense and somewhat impenetrable thing.
Yeah. I mean, I was honestly like a little nervous to jump into this because it is like so impenetrable. And some of these sounds are like literally things you've never heard before. So they can be somewhat hard to describe. But, you know, again, thank you so much to the aepages.org. Without a guide, I think it is still impenetrable. And so I hope, you know, this podcast serves as a guide in another way. Next time, our first subscribers only bonus episode is going to be on the TUS Rush Up Edge. We'll hope you join us by heading over to patreon.com/gonkcast. And whether you're a subscriber or not, we want to know what you think about that TUS record. Email us gonkcastpod@gmail.com. And then after that, another main episode for everyone that'll be on 2022-set B. So send us your thoughts. Send us your thoughts on A, B, 2. Since we didn't get to hear from many of you on that, remember, we love hearing from you, but try to make it clear which comments and questions you want us to read on the show specifically. And if you like the show, help us out a lot by subscribing and leaving us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on social media. All that is at Gonkcast Pod. And because something happened with Twitter, I've now created a blue sky. And I guess you say at Gonkcast on that. I don't know. It's like gonkcast.bspsky or whatever. But if you just search Gonkcast, it comes up. And even if you just search Autechr, it comes up, which I'm gaming the algorithms over there, you know. So follow us over there, Instagram. I don't use the Twitter anymore. We'll see you next time.
See ya.